Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Saturday, December 8th, 2018. I'm Sam Minter, and once again, Yvonne Bo is not here. He's doing some crazy stuff. He was in Asia for a while. I think he's back in the States now. But then he had a meeting tonight, and so whatever. Schedules could not work out. And once again, coming to rescue the show, we have Ed. Hello, Ed.
Hello.
So the agenda for today, of course, we're going to cover the big news of the various players in Trump Russia who have had things happen this week. So that's Flynn, Cohen, and Manafort. And that's, we're going to do our first segment on all of that sort of Trump Russia stuff, get it out of the way, talk about it. And, you know, in, sometimes we've tried to do this before where let's talk about Flynn in one segment and then let's talk about Cohen in another and then Manafort in a third. We're not going to try to do that. We'll sort of talk about the whole situation as all of that comes together into a bigger picture. So we'll do one segment on that, and it's probably going to be our longest segment, to be honest. But then moving beyond that, Ed wanted to highlight a couple different things. There was an article that came out this week about some people working at Trump's Bedminster golf course in New Jersey, were his housekeepers who worked on Trump's own rooms and stuff like that, who it turns out were illegal immigrants. So we'll talk about that. And then there was an interesting Supreme Court case that came up this week about double jeopardy, specifically when a person is charged by both the state and both the federal government and a state government for what it looks like the same underlying crime. And there are ramifications of that, of course, for the Donald Trump scenario, but more generally, it's an issue that's come up a number of times and is was at SCOTUS this week. And then finally, there's a big hullabaloo over some potential election fraud in North Carolina that's holding up the certification of at least one House race. And there's quite a lot of, you know, stuff there going back. The person who was doing this apparently has done it before and et cetera. So we'll talk about that. That's the basic agenda. And I guess let's just jump right in to Flynn, Cohen, and Manafort. So basically what we've had this week is a flurry of sentencing memos. So basically on all three of these cases, we've gotten to the point where the judges are going to decide how much jail time these three people get. And so both the defense and prosecution are putting in these memos on what they think is fair. And so what's happening here is because sentencing gets to take into account not just the crime that the person was convicted of, but all kinds of other background about what the person has done in the past and, you know, are they sorry for it and all of this kind of stuff. The prosecutors, and this is both Mueller and the Southern District of New York, can use this as an opportunity to basically explain what was happening. And I guess the quick summaries of these before Ed and I start talking about them is the Flynn memo was heavily redacted. It did say that he provided all kinds of cooperation and he was very, very helpful and it was timely and good and extensive. And Mueller recommended to get no jail time at all, essentially. But most of it was redacted. So where it talked about what he provided help on, there was something that was referred to as a criminal case. There was something that was referred to as the Trump-Russia stuff. And then there was a third thing that was completely redacted. So we don't know what that is at all. And so that's basically what's going on with Flynn. The Manafort case, was basically talking about all the ways that he lied. And there are a number of things that he lied about, but specifically some of the new stuff that's come out in that statement, which a lot of this one was redacted as well. But some of the things that weren't were that he lied about his contacts with the campaign and the administration. So one of the interesting things here is there were continued contacts until May of this year, including up in February, if I'm remembering this right, in February, contacts with a quote unquote senior administration official. And so, you know, whatever Manafort was doing continued well after, you know, he was charged and he was going through all this stuff and, you know, and so it just kept going. And so that's undoubtedly part of, why they were unhappy with his cooperation. And then finally Cohen, there are a number of things in the Cohen document as well. And by the way, just to be clear, on all of these, I have not had time to read the full documents. I mean, the Cohen one was like 40 pages on its own. I haven't had time. I've read some of the summaries and some of the notes on these. But in the Cohen's document, he outlines the whole plan. Well, I shouldn't say he. The prosecutors in SDNY outline the back and forth of the schemes to pay off the porn star and the playmate, basically. And there are two parts of that. One is Cohen himself paying to get those stories squashed. And then there's the payment from the Trump Organization to reimburse him. And one of the critical parts in that document is it basically says flat out that Donald Trump was a co-conspirator. Back when Cohen did his allocution, he mentioned Donald Trump explicitly, but the prosecutors did not. In this document, it lays it out. The prosecutors directly lay it out. And what's interesting on that one as well is there were actually two documents, one from the SDNY and one from Mueller, about the level of cooperation they'd gotten from Cohen. And the one from Mueller was actually relatively nice, saying that, you know, yeah, he cooperated, he was helpful, blah, blah, blah. The one from SDNY was like, no, he did the bare minimum that he had to. We weren't satisfied at all. He should get 4 years. So.
Yeah. Didn't they say that he's only told the truth to them when he's pinned down and shown that what he's saying is a lie? And that's their biggest problem with him, is that he only tells the truth when he's can't tell a lie anymore.
Something like that. I mean, they basically said he only cooperated when he absolutely had to at the latest moment, et cetera. So that's roughly the three cases that are going on. So let's, I guess, talk about the conclusions we can draw from this. First of all, just all of the redactions that were involved, at least in the Flynn and Manafort cases, just indicate how much we still don't know. There were pages and pages that were fully redacted from these documents. And you know, referring to the nature of how these people helped, the nature of Manafort's lies, all of this stuff. And that indicates that there's information that is relevant to current ongoing investigations and or things that are classified that they're not ready to reveal to the public. Now, all of this information does, you know, the judge sees it all, but we don't get to see it yet. So there is a lot, to me, this indicates there's a lot still to come. And, you know, we keep hearing this is almost done, this is almost done, blah, you know, I don't think we're almost done. Now, it may well be that in the next 3 or 4 weeks, we get slammed with all kinds of new developments and it all wraps up in a month. But I don't think so. I think there's, it seems to me like, you know, Mueller's going through this systematically. And yes, he's getting to sort of higher up on the totem pole as we go. But I don't think we're almost done. I think we have months and months and months left of this.
I don't know how long we have left, but I there has to be some reason why Mueller has come out with this material at this point. Now, part of it is because obviously he was holding it until after the election to avoid influencing the election. Part of it is because some of the materials are beginning to mature and are ready to be filed. There's some speculation that one part of the Flynn memorandum that was not redacted had to do with saying that a high member of the transition team was involved with Flynn in what Flynn did. Now, that raises an issue in that person's mind that perhaps this is leading up to an indictment of the vice president, because the vice president is not protected from indictment, as is the president. And that would be kind of interesting. And that also might explain why Vice President Pence this week hired a personal attorney.
Maybe. There have been people for a long time saying, go after Pence first. Pence is in it deep. Manafort picked Pence and Pence knew what was going on. But compared to everything else, there's so little there. It seems to be much more on the speculative side than anything else. Like, yeah. 'Cause I mean, when we start talking about, Donald Trump Jr. or Kushner or any of these folks, well, we know about meetings that they were in, that were discussing certain things, that were, we've got evidence that's already in the public record showing that they were doing things that, is potentially not above board, right? And certainly with the people who we've already got charges against, Flynn, Cohen, Manafort, et cetera, we know all kinds of stuff about them. There's been barely a whisper about this Pence stuff, except from the folks who just seem to be really eager for, the nutso scenario where you get rid of Pence first, and then you get rid of Trump before you can replace Pence, and you end up with President Nancy Pelosi or something. this kind of stuff, I still categorize that as, fantasy land. It's people who really want a particular result trying to make up a scenario that'll get you there, as opposed to, hey, there's evidence that actually leads us to believe this is going there. Now, is it impossible? No. I mean, it certainly is true that Manafort was involved in picking Pence. It's certainly involved that Pence was, leading the transition, and a lot of these things that were going on happened during the transition. So maybe Pence is involved. I'm just saying that compared to everything else where we've got things in the public record already talking about them, you really don't have that with any sort of Pence scenario yet.
Yeah. Oh, that's I know. I was just pointing out that there are some speculations along that line. Getting back to Flynn, I can see that perhaps he's been very helpful to him. As a retired soldier, I frankly found myself upset by the recommendation that he not have any punishment. Anything that he did in full knowledge that it was illegal. He can't claim that, gee, I didn't know that was wrong.
Now let's talk specifically, just to give context to your statements here. The things what Flynn actually pled guilty to was lying to the FBI. The underlying behavior that led to that was that during the transition time, he was making a number of contacts with the Russian government about sanctions and about a UN resolution on Israel. And that by itself potentially is a violation of an old law called the Logan Act, which has never been used to prosecute anybody.
Twice 1800s, I guess.
Even then it was not done successfully. There's that. And so you can actually make the case that those kinds of interactions actually sort of makes sense. You know, when the incoming administration is like, hey, you know, hold off, don't do anything crazy because we're going to change all the policies when we get in a few weeks anyway. That's not an unreasonable message to give. But then when he was asked about it, he lied about it repeatedly in multiple contexts, both to the public, to, you know, Mike Pence, as we were talking about, and to the FBI. And the reason that became a concern was because, you know, the Russians knew the right answer. He was lying about it. Theoretically, this gives leverage over, hey, we'll tell the truth if you don't blah, blah, blah. And add to that a number of things that were not part of the charges that happened so far, but you know, he'd been working closely with the Russians for a couple years, and you know, there's that famous picture of him and Jill Stein with Putin at some dinner in Moscow. He was also acting as an agent for the Turkish government, and had not properly disclosed that either. And so all of this stuff was going on. So there are a lot of questionable things Flynn was doing. And so your take on it is that, you know, you feel like he knew all of that stuff that he was doing was wrong and there's no excuse, right?
Basically, yeah. Yeah. And including lying to the FBI. I mean, other people, Martha Stewart went to jail for, 2 years for that.
Mm-hmm.
And hers was a lot less serious than this. So that's a crime that we've punished in the past, and now basically he's given a walk. Now, maybe he gave them a whole lot of really valuable information, but I don't know. I found that distracting. I think that sends a bad message to our soldiers and sailors about how they should react if they're called in to testify.
Yeah, I mean, they're part of the message that they were giving that was they – really emphasized in those charging documents for Flynn that it was quite important that not only did he end up cooperating, but he started cooperating extremely quickly. Like basically as soon as he was caught, he was like, okay, you're right. You got me. How can I help? You know? And that what he gave was it was very valuable and led to other people cooperating, et cetera. I mean, that's the case they're making.
At least he clearly began as soon as he was broke and out of work, and they were going after his son also because his son had worked for him in various of these things. And so at that point he said, okay, take me, leave my son alone, and I can't defend myself, so I'm at your mercy.
Right.
So it wasn't terribly early.
No.
He was out of options.
So let's talk a little bit about the Cohen case for a second. And I'm going to refer to a very good Twitter thread that Yvonne mentioned on our Curmudgeon's Corner Slack. Otherwise, I may not have seen it. But it's by Kurt Eichenwald. His Twitter handle is KURTEICHENWALD, Kurt Eichenwald. In any case, he mentions that he's sort of been an expert writing about corporate crime for the last 20 some years. And that you really have to look at this in the light of corporate crime, because people, according to him, like people were missing sort of the main point of this. Now, the thing people have really focused on is there's one part of the document where they say, you know, Cohen was directed by Trump to make these payments, which were campaign finance violations. And therefore, you know, basically the government is directly saying Trump committed felonies. We may not be able to indict him right now, but he committed this felony. What Eichenwald's point in talking about this was, I mentioned earlier, there were sort of two halves of this. One was Cohen paying the National Enquirer and the porn star to shut up and be quiet and not do anything. And the other was the Trump Organization paying back Cohen. Now, what Kurt Eichenwald points out is that first payment, Cohen to the porn stars, that you could conceivably make all sorts of arguments about that in terms of it was a minor, it was a technical violation. He didn't know that, yes, he was making payments, but, if it was just to, if it wasn't really about the campaign, if it was Trump, wanting Melania not to find out, then maybe you get off in the same way that Edwards got off a few years ago for essentially doing the same kind of thing. And there are a lot of sort of nuances to that first half of it, even though you've got, that's where they've directly pinned, Trump directed it, was on that first payment, the one from Cohen to the women. But the second payment, where the Trump organization pays back Cohen, implicates a lot of things. And basically, this is the Trump organization. They got the CFO to testify in this, and it's Alan Weisselberg, who's worked for Trump for decades, to talk about this. And apparently there were senior Trump organization people who signed off on these payments. And it's unclear, is that Donald himself? Is it Donald Jr.? Is it Eric? Is it Ivanka? Who is it that signed off? Unclear, but multiple people were involved, which makes it a conspiracy, A. And B, it's not just the campaign finance at that point, but there's also money laundering because of the way they structured it. They did a variety of things to hide what these payments were and their potential tax implications as well. Because, some of these things were labeled as legal services or whatever, and were, their implications to whether or not they deducted them on the corporate taxes and all kinds of other stuff. I don't know those details. But that second payment, because it's more involved, has more people, the corporation is involved, and there's clear intent to deceive and hide the purpose of these transactions, implicates a whole bunch of other laws. And so that is potentially even more serious and covering more people. Now, from the documents that came out today, it's unclear if Donald himself was involved in that second half, but other members of his family almost certainly were. And so there's no like easy excuse like, it had nothing to do with the campaign. It was all about Melania or anything like that for those second things. So that's a very interesting part of things as well. But I still look at these, frankly, on these particular charges here and go, what's the reaction going to be here? Because, if Donald Trump wasn't president, I've heard so many commentators in the last few hours since these came out say, if Donald Trump wasn't president, there'd be no doubt whatsoever, these are indictable offenses, and they'd go after him for this. Although if he wasn't president, this investigation never would have happened, and he probably would have gotten away with it, right? But assuming this is known, this is clearly indictable stuff. But because he's president, and the DOJ guidelines for a long time have said you can't indict a sitting president, although it's never been tested in court, they probably won't indict him. So maybe this stuff ends up in an impeachment process. But I can already see, and frankly, actually, the usual suspects have been really quiet today. I haven't heard a lot from Republicans commenting on this yet. But I can already hear in my head the people saying, this is stupid campaign finance stuff. It's a process crime. It doesn't really matter. There's no collusion. Where are the Russians in this? This has nothing to do with anything. Sure, he paid off the porn star and the playmate, but, so what? Who cares, right? This isn't a big deal. And I honestly, yes, this is a felony. And yes, in a just world, he would be charged for it and would pay the price appropriately. But in real life, I sort of see, like, if this is all, it becomes politically difficult. Like, I don't see, I don't see all the Republican faithful abandoning Donald Trump over this. I don't even see, like, you know, a bunch of senators abandoning Donald Trump over this alone. But that's where we get into, how does this fit into everything else? You know, because it's not just, you know, this is the one thing that came out of this was, you know, Cohen talking about Donald Trump Trump being directly involved in this particular thing. But elsewhere in all these documents, there are all kinds of additional details about, you know, when we're talking about Cohen and Manafort, you know, communications between Trump and Russians and this and that. And at the very least, it's becoming more and more clear with every document that the Russians were certainly trying really, really hard to compromise Donald Trump. In almost every single case, that, you know, they're offering, you know, they're offering help in terms of, you know, we've got dirt on Hillary Clinton. They're, you know, getting him involved in the Trump Tower real estate deal and all kinds of, you know, potential implications of quid pro quos. And none of that is proven yet, but it's getting closer. I'm looking at an article right now in Wired magazine by Garrett Graff. The Mueller investigation nears the worst case scenario. And he mentions, you know, over a year ago, and we talked about this on the show, on Lawfare, Benjamin Witz and, how do you say her name? Quinta Jurek, outlined 7 possible scenarios about Trump and Russia. And, you know, we don't have to go through all 7, but they ranged from fairly innocent. Like, the theory number 1 was it's a giant set of coincidence and disconnected events. And it ramped up from there, to the last few being, the 5th on the list was Russian intelligence actively penetrated the Trump campaign and Trump knew or should have known. And then number 6 was compromat. And number 7, the most extreme scenario, is the president of the United States is a Russian agent. And basically, with everything we know right now, it seems we've already eliminated the 4 bottom, you know, cases here, the sort of innocent ones. And we're at least at number 5, which is Russian intelligence actively penetrated the Trump campaign and Trump either knew or should have known. Because we've got all of this, each one of these, it just outlines more and more of the contacts and more of the connections. And more to the point, I guess, like, the repeated theme on a lot of these is the lying about them over and over and over again, where, you know, yeah, like, on taking the Flynn example that we were talking about a minute ago, where Flynn could have said, yeah, you know, I am talking to the Russians. It's a normal part. I'm going to be the national security advisor in a couple weeks. So we're having some preliminary conversations just so that they know what to expect from us when we get in. And everybody would have been like, oh, okay. Yeah. But once you start lying about it and denying this and denying that, and Donald Trump saying he's never done any business in Russia and never wanted to, and blah, 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 and all of these people denying meeting after meeting, it starts, well, what are they denying? Because why the lies?
Well, exactly. If you're doing something that's not illegal or at least unethical, then you don't need to lie. So then you say, well, why did he lie? And the only reason I can come up with is that Flynn thought he was breaking a law.
I mean, with all of these folks in all of these situations, it's just a repeated theme. And there appears to be efforts to where the people coordinated stories with each other. So we'll probably end up with a lot more of these lying to Congress kinds of things. You know, we had reports last week out of the Trump White House of all kinds of people being shocked that they would actually charge lying to Congress. And so, yeah, it looks like there was coordination of, you know, here's what we're going to tell Congress. And so there might be a whole bunch of people potentially looked at for that once the Democrats are in power and can hand over transcripts of various conversations. It's just, it continues to look bad. And no, we don't have the whole picture yet. But the denials of, oh, this is nothing, this is just a witch hunt, this is Democrats out to get him for no reason, just are on thinner and thinner ice with every new revelation. And, you know, I don't know the full story here. And nobody outside of the people investigating it or directly involved know at this point. But it does not look good. It does not look good at all. So I don't know. We'll as usual, we'll have to wait and see what comes next. But I think it's the one thing that's come out, just to be clear, whether or not it's a significant enough thing that you could get Republicans to flip in such a way that made impeachment a real possibility. This week, and it wasn't even Mueller's office, the Southern District of New York. So the Justice Department itself, in a document they produced, said Donald Trump committed felonies because he directed Cohen in his felonies. And that is also felonious. And so we didn't even, you know, I get tongue-tied on this again because it's just like this is unprecedented. I mean, we're definitely in Watergate territory, but arguably we're well beyond Watergate territory in terms of what's happened already and what's been said.
This time with a different Congress.
Yes. So okay. Anything else to say on Flynn, Cohen, Manafort? I guess we said the least about Manafort, but I don't know that there's that much.
Yeah, in some ways, that may be the most damaging because he was the one. Isn't Manafort the one that was most involved with the preparing to do the Trump Tower in Russia?
No, that was Cohen. That was Cohen.
Was that Cohen? Okay. Well, because clearly the negotiations on that were still going on well after the campaign was done. It was in action.
Yeah, no. Manafort is involved in different areas of it, but some of the things that he was that they are saying that he lied about when he wasn't cooperating the way he should have been are some of his contacts with Russians and some of his contacts with administration officials. And to me, one of the key parts there was the fact that those contacts with administration officials, including senior administration officials, continued through just a few months ago.
Yep.
Which, you know, a recurring theme that I keep shaking my head about on this show is we're not just talking about crimes that happened during the campaign or during the transition. We are talking about things that are continuing to happen.
Yeah.
Like straight through the Trump administration, arguably to this very day, because some of Donald Trump's tweets are arguably witness tampering or obstruction of justice, you know, and just because he's doing it in public doesn't mean it's not breaking the law.
Absolutely.
And we'll see if Donald Trump, we'll see if Mueller decides to go after some of these things, because so far we haven't seen anything really about the obstruction of justice side of things. Aside from Manafort doing some witness tampering, mostly things have been concentrated in other areas so far. But you sort of see, you know, Mueller spiraling inward, and you know, it's incredibly frustrating from the outside because you want to jump to the end, you want to turn to the end of the book and see how it turns out. But we don't get that luxury. We have to see it continue to unfold week after week. And this was a relatively big week for that.
Yeah, it was actually the last 24 hours have been incredible. Yeah.
Okay, let's take a break and we will talk about all the other stuff that we have to talk about.
Sounds good.
So next up is Trump's housekeepers. Back after this.
Okay.
Hey, we know when you listen to this show, you have thoughts about what we say. You probably want to vent about what we got wrong or what we left out, right? Or maybe you want to suggest some future topics we just haven't gotten to yet. Well then, tell us all about it. Right now, there are four ways to get feedback to us. First, you can go to the Curmudgeon's Corner Facebook page and leave comments on the post where we announce all the new episodes. Second, you could go to curmudgeonscorner.com, that's with a hyphen, and leave a comment there instead. Third, both Yvonne and I are on Twitter. You can talk to me at Abulsme, A-B-U-L-S-M-E, or Yvonne at I-M-B-O, I-M-B-O-U. Finally, if you don't want to make your comments in a public forum like that, just email me directly at abulsme@abulsme.com. Again, that's A-B-U-L-S-M-E. But, you know, if you don't want us to mention your feedback on the show, be sure to say so, because otherwise we're probably going to respond to your comments on a future show, because, you know, that's what makes the discussion. Thanks, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Okay, we are back. So, Ed, you know, I sort of insisted we had to do the Flynn, Cohen, Manafort stuff because it was the big news of the week. The next three are all you. So Trump's housekeepers, give us a little briefing on the story and then, tell us what you think about it.
Well, this just came out, I think yesterday, one of the attorneys, has lauded a suit in which Trump was, had hired, at least two illegal aliens as housekeepers on the, New Jersey, I forget which golf course it was, but
Bedminster.
The Bedminster, yeah. And several things about it. Number one, that they were illegal aliens with pretty easily proven documents that were forged. Number two is that from what the attorney for these two women is saying, there's evidence that after Trump was elected, their supervisors began abusing them, not physically maybe, but certainly mentally, threatening them that if they didn't do such and such, they would be deported, and really abusing these people in a manner that they hadn't particularly in the past. And then the third thing is that the two women also alleged that there are a whole bunch more illegal aliens working for this man who was supposed to get rid of all illegal aliens. The only funny business out of the whole thing is that in one of the late night shows last night, the comedian commented that we knew he was going to build a wall, but we didn't know he would put a service entrance in it.
Yeah. So just for completeness here, the article about this was from the New York Times, Making President Trump's Bed, a Housekeeper Without Papers. It was written by Miriam Jordan and came out on December 6th. And so we've heard all this stuff before. I mean, this article was particularly interesting because they got two people to come out on the record with their names, telling about their stories. Whereas the other stuff we've heard is just sort of generally, oh yeah, they're probably illegal immigrants at Mar-a-Lago and these other things. Or we've heard that Donald Trump was making extensive use of certain visas for temporary workers and things like that, that he was also arguing against. But is anybody surprised that Donald Trump is a hypocrite?
Oh, I hope not. I think I'm more disturbed by the fact that it sounds like the employees are being ill-treated after his ascendancy to the presidency than by the fact that he hired them.
So talk more about that part of things then.
Well, I think what it shows is that his supervisors, he's not involved in that, but the supervisors at least interpret his being in such a position of power that they can abuse their employees and maltreat them and do things that ordinarily they wouldn't be able to get away with, which is, of course, what eventually leads to lawsuits. And, you know, eventually in all sorts of areas, you start out with little stuff and you build and build and build until something really bad happens. Well, it sounds like this is approaching being egregious. Mm-hmm. And it just smells bad, I guess is the worst of it. We know that there are lots of illegal aliens doing these. I mean, a lot of people say the motel industry would almost not exist without illegal aliens because United States citizens aren't going to be willing to work that kind of work for that kind of money. Mm. But then if that's the case, we need to figure out a way to allow aliens to come in and do those jobs.
Yeah, and this is some of the arguments about temporary visas and other things like that to let people in, or just let them in permanently for this kind of stuff. And that's not to say, I don't know, it's not to say these jobs can only be filled by illegal immigrants, like you said. Like, I mean, there's an argument here of why we should pay them more. You know, that's part of the problem here. But there's certainly what you see here. I guess what the one woman said for this article was basically she actually told them she was not did not have her documentation in order, and they said they don't care.
Yeah.
Now, to be fair, this was a number of years ago. This was not like last week that this happened. Yeah, I mean, look, again, who's surprised at Donald Trump being a hypocrite? This is completely normal for Donald Trump. You would be shocked if this wasn't the case, to be honest.
Yeah, I have to agree with that.
Okay, let's just move on then to the double jeopardy hearing that you mentioned. So again, why don't you give some background on this, and then we'll talk about it.
Okay, this is a case, a man by the name of Campbell, or Gamble, G-A-M-B-L-E, was arrested. I believe it was in Ohio. He was picked up, a traffic stop, and when they did the search in connection with the traffic stop, discovered a firearm in his car. He was a previously convicted felon, which makes it a crime for him to have a firearm in both Ohio and federal law. So the Ohio state filed charges against him, tried him, convicted him of illegal possession of a firearm, and sentenced him to a year in prison. Then the federal government filed charges against him, same crime, illegal possession of a firearm, tried him, convicted him, and sentenced him to 3 years. His point is, this is double jeopardy. It was the same crime. I've been tried twice. I've had to pay to defend myself twice. Now I'm going to be serving 4 years for what was originally going to be a one-year sentence. That is being appealed and was heard, I believe, today in the Supreme Court, the initial arguments. No final outlet. But where I stumbled across it was in the a blog called The Volokh Conspiracy, where they were discussing the whole issue of the separate jurisdictions and the fact that this is only about 150-year-old concept. In the original writing of the Constitution, they said you should not be tried more than once in the same jurisdiction. If you're found innocent once, you're innocent. You cannot be tried again for that same crime. Well, somewhere along the line, we decided, well, the states and the federals are separate sovereignties, and therefore, if the state has tried you and the feds also want to try you, then they can. Generally, it hasn't been much of an issue because one of the two has ceded sovereignty. So, for instance, in a court-martial...
And in many cases, the laws cover sort of different things anyway, so that you don't have the exact same thing in both levels.
is writing more and more laws all the time. And they're beginning to overlap, like this one is overlapping more and more frequently. The area where I first ever encountered it was in the military, because the military laws under the Uniform Code of Military Justice are very similar to many state laws. And it turns out that, for instance, if a soldier kills his wife, then that's a crime under both UCMJ and under state law. Generally, the military will say, okay, state, you try him. And they will, you know, turn over the sovereignty to him. However, if the state finds that soldier innocent, there's nothing preventing the feds from then firing charges of murder against the soldier under UCMJ and try him again in federal court, because UCMJ is a federal court. And if this particular act, if the Supreme Court, for instance, should come down and say, no, you only get tried once for a crime, whatever jurisdiction it was tried under, that could change the UCMJ greatly. Because typically, for those sorts of crime, if a soldier gets caught in a speed trap, he frequently will get punished both by the state and by his commander, two places. So it'll really affect military jurisprudence, I suspect.
Well, and there are a number of other places it could be. Like, so backing up for a second, my initial reaction to all of this stuff is, completely aside from like the Donald Trump stuff where people are talking about, well, you know, if he pardons people, then they could still be tried under state law for various things. So like that's come up specifically in terms of some of the stuff Manafort's doing. If he pardons his kids, if he does this, you know, people keep talking about, you know, well, maybe they can't do, he can pardon himself at the federal level, but he can't do anything about states, so New York could go after him or whatever. Aside from that, my immediate reaction is, you know, that actually is unfair. You know, it certainly seems like the idea of protection against double jeopardy as a fundamental concept doesn't care about the nuance of dual sovereigns. You know, it's like if I'm tried once for doing this thing and I'm found innocent, then, or not guilty, the next sovereign down the list shouldn't be able to go after me too. That's my immediate reaction is, yeah, this isn't fair. It's not fair to allow you to have multiple shots at that. You know, if you go through the process and you're found innocent, that's it. You know, the flip side of that, first of all, let's just say if there's new evidence brought to light or whatever, and this applies to double jeopardy, even in the same jurisdiction, it doesn't seem right from a justice point of view. If you find somebody not guilty, you let them go, and then you find evidence that would have proven them guilty that wasn't available, that you can't reopen that and have that trial again. But also, some of the things that have been brought up specifically related to this dual immunity concept is it's not just federal versus state, although that's important. It also applies to, you know, U.S. versus some other country. Or so that, you know, if somebody is charged in another country for a crime and it's basically ignored and they do a shoddy trial and blah, 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 but we know that they're guilty, would we be able to try them as well? And like some of the examples brought up are like, you know, somebody accused of a terrorist act and they're initially tried in Iraq or somewhere and Iraq decides to let them go, but then we catch them. Can we try them for that same crime? And the dual sovereigns says, yeah, we potentially could, although there are other issues there about like why would U.S. law apply outside the U.S. and vice versa and stuff like that. There are other issues there. Another thing that is brought up is right now there are a number of places where specifically in terms of civil rights laws and things like that, where the federal government can step in and apply federal charges if they believe the state or local authorities have been intentionally light on some crime, where, you know, the white person killed a black man, and so who cares? The jury in Alabama or whatever lets them go. And then the federal government says, you know, that's an injustice. Let's go after him on, you know, some civil rights laws covering the same underlying crime. So there are a lot of potential implications of this, beyond just the simple case of, hey, there was a state and federal law that exactly overlapped and you're charging them for both things at the same time. So yeah, when you add all those complexities in, I'm not sure where I stand, but I don't expect, to be honest, that the Supreme Court is going to change anything.
Yep.
This is precedent that's been there for 150 years or so. I forget exactly how long, but a long time.
Yeah.
That this is how we operate, and overturning it, as you said, would have all kinds of implications for the military, for civil rights laws, for this, for that. It would be a very significant change if the Supreme Court decided to get rid of this, overturning a very long history of use of this doctrine. So it would be surprising, I think, if the Supreme Court changed their mind on this.
Nothing surprises me anymore, though.
True.
On the one example you gave, though, in the cases, a number of cases in the 60s during the civil rights uprisings, there were murders committed where state courts found people innocent. The feds did not retry those as murders. They tried them as denial of civil rights. And at the time, that was specifically to avoid the double jeopardy, even though it was separate sovereignty. So I'm not sure that would be as much of an issue. I think.
Well, and that's where you get into a gray area with this stuff, too, because the one case is you have exactly overlapping laws, like they make the exact same thing illegal at the two levels. The other is one act can potentially violate multiple laws. So, yes, you committed a murder, but it was also depriving the person of their civil rights, and it was also doing this, and it was also doing that. And each of those could potentially be separate crimes. And I don't know. This is another area I haven't studied enough to have a strong opinion on. But should it really be about which laws you violated? I mean, yes, of course it should be about which laws you violated. But should the fact that there's a common underlying act also be relevant? You know, should it really be possible that one act that I commit, ties into like 30 laws I violated all at once?
So to me, that's the real issue, is that in this case, the charges were exactly the same. That was possession of an illegal weapon,
right?
In two separate trials. And again, it kind of even comes down to the economics of it, in that, if I were charged with that, I would be able to defend myself. I could afford it. It might break me, but I could afford it. But a lot of people would end up in prison because they couldn't afford to protect against two trials, maybe one. But
well, I mean, there's a whole separate issue there about how the whole criminal justice system completely screws over anybody that doesn't have money. You know, from bail to the cost of lawyers to everything else, if you don't have a nice chunk of change to defend yourself, you're completely screwed.
Yep.
But anyway, it's an interesting issue and it has lots of implications. We'll see what the court does. I found it interesting that this even made it to the court, given how old a precedent this was.
I'm only surprised that actually it has been in there one other time, but it was a different issue, and I didn't read that much about it, but in Volokh they talk about it being a slightly different issue the last time, but this time it seems to me that I wouldn't be surprised what they say, that you can't be charged with the same crime twice, especially if you're convicted the first time. To convict a guy who's already been convicted of a crime says, well, we want him punished more.
Yeah, I mean, I could see some sort of compromise there, that if it really was identical, you know, treat it differently than sort of overlapping but not identical crimes that cover the same underlying act. But fundamentally, I guess the fiction that does this is that there's two completely independent jurisdictions, and what constrains one shouldn't constrain the other. And I guess that's not a fiction, but that's the conceit, I should say, around this notion. And I don't see them giving that up. But we'll see. And as usual, I am not a lawyer. Ed is not a lawyer. You know, so we have no idea what we're talking about here. I know we've got several, I think, lawyers listening who are regular listeners, at least one, but I think maybe more than one. So feel free to send us some feedback to let us know everything we got wrong. I'll give all the feedback information at the end of the show. Tell us what we screwed up, and we'll relay that to our listeners. Okay. Final issue, and I'm not taking a break between these because they've been relatively short, but final issue, and then we'll wrap up the show, I think, even if it's a little bit of a short show. That's okay. We do that sometimes. Is this thing going on in North Carolina? Like, there's been all of this talk, you know, from Republicans about, you know, we have to make everybody show ID, and we have to make sure that there are no people coming and voting that shouldn't be voting, and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, those kinds of cases of what they call in-person voter fraud are extremely rare. They do exist. They have happened. They're just very rare. But what's happened here is a systematic effort, it looks like, by a Republican operative. And I believe the scam is basically that they sign people up for absentee ballots and then go try to collect those ballots from those people and fill them out for them and then turn them in. And so basically people go to vote and they find out they can't vote because they already got an absentee ballot or they already voted absentee or something like that. So it's, on the one hand, it's a form of voter suppression, but even worse, it looks like they're actually voting for people. Do I have that roughly right, Ed?
I think so. Actually, it's a little worse, because what they were doing was they were going out to specifically elderly people of minority racial conditions and saying to them, well, let me help you make out your ballot. And then would fill a ballot out for them and then say, okay, I'll go and mail this for you. Or if the person said, well, I've already made out my ballot, but I'll let you go mail it. Those ballots they threw away.
Right.
Because they were sure how those people had voted. So if you will, this is sort of an extension of what's been going on in many states already, which is, let's figure out ways to make minorities, it's really geared against minorities. Let's make it hard for minorities to vote. And if all else fails, let's make sure their votes don't count. So we've had states that say, well, you have to have a voter ID, and in order to get it, you have to drive 300 miles to get it. And it has to be Monday between 11 o'clock and 1 o'clock, or that office is closed. Or they say, you have that voter ID, but your signature on it is slightly different than the one on the registration. So your vote is canceled. You can't vote. Or they have an armed policeman standing at the gate, knowing that a lot of people in minorities are very nervous about walking around armed policemen. Can't understand why this day and age they would be, but they are. So they, rather than voting, they go. All of these are part and parcel of the same thing, which is, let's make sure that a group of people who we know will vote as a general rule, kind of similarly, let's make sure they don't get to vote. Or that if they do vote, we voted for them and cast their vote. We were trying to help them.
Well, going back to this specific case in North Carolina, first of all, the guy who did this was hired by the Republican candidate, but apparently had done this in previous elections too, and had actually gotten caught by the election board before, but nothing had been done about it.
Well, they didn't care.
Yeah, I mean, well, this was a bipartisan election board that had caught him before, and they'd actually referred him for prosecution, but nothing happened with that prosecution, and then so he does it again.
Actually, I understand that he still owes the candidate who won the election still owes this guy $4,300 or something.
Oh, nice. So the bipartisan election board here, to their credit, discovered this. They saw some anomalies in the results. I mean, basically, this county had a far higher rate of requests for absentee ballots than anywhere else in the state. And the results that were coming in looked fishy in a variety of different ways that they could be looked at by statistical analysis and other things. And the election board started digging into it, started an investigation, and basically refused to certify these results based on the irregularities. So they're still trying to figure out what to do with it. The investigation is still ongoing. The possibility has been raised that they're just going to have a whole new election because this is tainted so badly they can't fix it.
They're going to have the re-election. There's no way they can have certify this as a fair election. They have to re-vote.
And it was close enough, by the way. The Republican won by about 1,000 votes.
Yeah.
You know, this is a place you probably don't expect the Democrat to win. But, you know, with everything else that happened in this election, you never know. And it was relatively close as these things go. The Democrat had conceded the day after the election. He's now unconceded. And we'll see where this goes. But
I'd have to wonder if they indeed prove that the I can't remember what his name is, the guy who won the election, Dixon or something like that. If he indeed hired this man to do this, then that's a felony.
Well, here's the thing as well. Apparently, the same thing happened in the primary because the Republican running here won against the incumbent representative. The Republican, so there was a Republican already in office here. He lost in the primary to this guy. And apparently, this stuff happened in the primary too. So that actually brings up to me, like, do you have to redo the primary as well? I mean, and I guess the answer is the primary was already certified. That already happened. So they're not undoing this. This time they caught it before it was certified so they can undo this. So they probably wouldn't redo the primary. But I could see, you know, that Republican who got kicked out of office has a real gripe here, you know. And he apparently, that Republican who lost in the primary, did sort of raise his hand and say, hey, wait a second, this stuff looks weird, but it, you know, didn't stop anything at that point.
Yeah.
But
well, if the congressman, I use that term loosely, is indeed found guilty of a felony, I guess you don't get removed from Congress for that unless the House removes him. But I can't imagine that he would be able to win in a re-election, a re-vote.
Well, you never know. Partisanship is very strong. Now, just for the record, you'd given the name wrong. The Republican in that race is Mark Harris.
Harris.
And the Democrat is Dan McCready. So,
yeah.
We'll see what happens there, but there's certainly a chance that they do a revote. And if they do a revote, especially if Harris is directly implicated in all of this, there's certainly a chance that McCready wins and brings the Democratic gains in this last election from 40 to 41. Who knows? But the one thing to say about this though, is at least lately, and I know there's all kinds of history of both parties doing all kinds of shenanigans. People will always bring up the Chicago political machine and all kinds of stuff like that. But lately, there's been all of this hemming and hawing by Republicans about, you know, the voter ID and everything else they need to keep people from voting that shouldn't vote. That's extremely rare problem. Whenever we've found something systematic, It's the Republicans. I mean, and there's this kind of stuff, but also, as you said earlier, all of the other types of voter suppression that are just tactics to take groups that you don't think are going to vote for you and try to get them not to vote. You know, it's just, you know, in a proper functioning democracy, you should want everybody to vote. And you should have a sort of fundamental principle of like, we're all above board here. Here's what we would do if we're in office. Here's what they're, all of this nonsense about, trying to slime the other person and do this and do that. And yeah, it works, but it's clearly unhealthy, You want to have an honest evaluation of all the candidates and decide who's best. And yes, that includes the negative aspects of what they do. All of these dirty tricks, and we're clearly talking about them in national level for 2016, but all of this kind of stuff too, is just, it's so unhealthy. It's what kills democracies, is this kind of stuff.
Well, a lot of this comes back to saying, well, the states are supposed to run the elections. And indeed, that's right. The states are sovereign in that. On the other hand, the federal government is charged with making sure that elections are fair. So it seems to me pretty clear that the federal government needs to have some legislation that says gerrymandering is illegal. Certainly racial gerrymandering is illegal. And this sort of thing is illegal under federal government law and a number of other issues. And that comes back to the fact that the Voting Rights Act back in the 60s really diminished the impact of this kind of stuff for a long time until a couple of years ago when we decided, well, we don't need it anymore. There is no segregation in the United States. We don't have any voter suppression, so we can get rid of the Voting Rights Act and not have that legislation impacting our election. To me, the most important thing our new Congress can do is to reintroduce an effective Voting Rights Act and get that sucker pushed through.
Yeah, that it'll never get through to Republican Senator Donald Trump, even if the House does something. But the House could put something symbolic. But I agree with you at a higher level. You know, the fact that we do have all of these systems for, you know, that elections are different everywhere across the country is somewhat crazy. There should be standardized ways of doing it nationwide, in terms of how voter registration works, how ballots work, how you're able to vote, absentee ballot, all of these kinds of things. And I've said before, I really like the way Washington State does it. I think we should do that everywhere. But whatever the solution is, the fact that it is handled on the state and local level is actually kind of crazy.
You mentioned Washington a couple times, though. My concern is, isn't that all mail-in ballots?
100% by mail ballots, yes.
And that is what is going on in North Dakota, is mail-ins.
Well, in North Carolina. Yeah, well, they're definitely like that. That is something to be said, that it is potentially easier to do shenanigans with a mail-in ballot than it is in person, for a variety of reasons. But I don't think there's evidence that the states that have mail-in ballots have had a significantly worse problem with anything like that than anybody else. So, I think that's something you can figure out separately and is outweighed by the massively increased convenience and ease of voting.
Yeah. No, I agree with it. I like the idea, but I'm very concerned that seeing what's happened with the mail-in ballots in North Carolina, that there needs to be something done to prevent that. And I'm not sure how you would go about preventing that, because that's really scary.
Right. Okay. Well, I have one more topic to bring up that I did not introduce at the beginning, but I would be remiss if I did not mention something in this show, which is, if I have counted correctly, and I may not have, I've screwed this up before, but if I have counted correctly, this is the 600th episode of Curmudgeon's Corner.
Hoo-ah!
Yeah, so 600 episodes, yay! We can have a little party. So yeah, we've been doing this a while, and that's only of the podcast version. That's not counting the radio show that Yvonne and I did in the '90s. But yes, 600 episodes, been doing this a long time, like 11 and a half years or so. So
that's almost as many episodes as MASH had.
There you go. Okay. This has been another episode of Curmudgeon's Corner. So first of all, thank you, Ed. It was good having you yet again. And here's all the usual contact information I give at the end. Facebook.com/curmudgeonscorner. You can come on, you can comment, you can do all this kind of stuff. You can send me feedback directly, feedback@curmudgeons-corner.com if you want to do it by email. If you really like the show, patreon.com/curmudgeonscorner to give us a tip, essentially, and at $2 a month or more, you can get invited to our Curmudgeon's Corner Slack, which is a lot of fun. We just talk throughout the week, share links to interesting news stories, all of that kind of stuff. I'm on Twitter at Abulsme, A-B-U-L-S-M-E. Ed is not on Twitter. Ed's never on Twitter. Shame, shame.
I find it's not distasteful. That's not the right word. I just don't find it conducive to how I like to converse.
There you go. What was the last thing I was going to say? I don't even remember what the last thing was. What did I forget, Ed? Did I forget something? Was it critical?
Yvonne's Twitter handle.
Oh, I can give that. He's not here, so who cares, right? It's at IMBOU, I-M-B-O-U, to get at my normal co-host's Twitter account. And I guess that's it. I guess, yeah. So thanks, everybody. I hope you enjoy the next week, and we will be back next time, probably with Yvonne again. We'll see if schedules allow. And, you know, have a great week. Talk to you next time. Goodbye.
Good night.